From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the January 2019 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Second Front Now. 1943 had been a year of turning points in the Second World War, but 75 years ago, few people could have known for certain the monumental events that would unfold in 1944. In this It Happened Here episode, we take stock and look at the year ahead. The big three, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin, met together for the first time, and they took decisions that would ultimately lead to the 6th of June, D-Day. In the wider war, the Germans had bogged the Allies down on the Italian front, while at sea, Bletchley Park saw success with their contribution in the sinking of the Scharnhorst. Meanwhile, back in the Buckinghamshire countryside, GPO engineer Tommy Flowers delivered Colossus 1 to Bletchley Park. Seen now as the world's first large-scale electronic digital computer, at the time, it was part of the evolution of machinery that the Codebreakers had at their disposal. As always, Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, is our guide.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
The title of this episode is Second Front Now, but what was the Second Front?
Second Front Now is a term that's coined by the Russians. There are actually several fronts going on by beginning of 1944. But ever since 1942, the Russians had been campaigning that they shouldn't be, as they saw it, doing all the heavy lifting in the war, because they, almost from Barbarossa, from the invasion of Russia in 1941 onwards, they have more troops fighting more Germans than anybody else. So they were very anxious that the Western allies, the UK and the US, should get on with attacking the Germans somewhere, and ideally in mainland Europe and in France, effectively. And Stalin had written to Churchill in March 1943 on this very point, saying, you know, when are you going to get on with it? The Russians have been quite successful up to that point. We've spoken in this podcast before about the Stalingrad campaign in winter of 42 into 43. And then you have the Battle of Kursk in the summer, where the great German counterattack that was supposed to restore the situation for the Germans was defeated. And so the Russians are doing pretty well, but they're also, in both of those attacks, both of those battles were extremely costly for the Russians as well as for the Germans. And so they're increasingly anxious for the Allies to get on with it. The problem is, on the Western Allied side, everyone isn't in agreement either. The Americans have a different view of perhaps how the war should be fought from the British.
You say the Allies weren't entirely in agreement. How did their perspectives differ?
Well, Churchill had outlined British strategy from way back before the war, and his focus has always been on the Mediterranean and the Italians and the links to Egypt, the Middle Eastern oil and India. So that's Britain's main sort of strategic axis. Also, during the First World War, he'd fought on the Western Front himself. And when he'd been in the Admiralty in those days, he'd been a champion of what in those days they called the indirect approach. And he was behind the operations in Gallipoli and things like that. He liked the Mediterranean as a theatre. So his view was that the war could potentially be won through Italy or through the Balkans, up through Greece into Romania, where the Germans got the oil from. And he was also sceptical that an attack against an intact German army in France would necessarily be a good idea.
And what did the Americans think then?
The Americans were much more about getting on with it, to basically to attack the Germans by the shortest route to Berlin, which would be an invasion of Western Europe, probably along the French coast somewhere. They were much more interested in a direct assault, you know, pick a small length of coast and attack it with all your effort. Whereas Churchill kept coming up with plans where they say, well, we'll have a simultaneous invasion in Norway and in France and in Italy and in Greece, and we'll spread the Germans around. That wasn't an idea that the Americans really went with. The other thing Churchill was kind of waiting for, and had been waiting for since 1941, was the idea that Germany would collapse somehow. And particularly with the bombing offensive that had really got into its stride in 1943 and would continue into the early part of 1944. Bomber Harris's philosophy that if you dropped enough bombs on Germany, either their economic infrastructure would collapse or their population would revolt and somehow Germany would start to crumble from within. The idea was that if something happened in Germany or the occupied populations of the rest of Europe did something, then the German army would be weakened enough that you could launch a cross-channel invasion against a weakened opponent. The idea that you'd attack it before it had suffered any kind of internal damage, he thought was just really risky.
So the approaches by the British and the Americans were so different. Did they see eye to eye at all? Was there any agreement?
There was agreement to a certain extent. From the very beginning of the war, the British had managed to persuade the Americans of the what's called the Germany First strategy, the idea that they would devote their major effort to defeating the Germans in Europe and then turn to the Japanese in the Pacific subsequently. And that's indeed how the war played out. But this tension still exists. The other thing both countries are aware of at the beginning of 1943 is that the resources aren't really where they need to be at this point. Stalin was saying we should have a second front, a European invasion, in the summer of 43. Neither Churchill nor the Americans really wanted one in the summer of 1943 because the Americans were still gearing up all their military forces in the US. Very few of them had arrived in the UK yet. And those that had come across the Atlantic had been fighting in North Africa and now fighting in Italy. There was a shortage of landing craft. All the material preparations you need for an invasion had begun, but hadn't really reached a point where they could be confident about the operation succeeding.
And were they aware of German preparations to counter such an invasion or an assault?
Very much so. And they were very concerned about German preparations. And this is where Bletchley fits in, because from the autumn of 1942 and right through 1943, Bletchley has been monitoring all the different German units in France, building up this order of battle of all the formations there. And this includes units that are disappearing off to Russia or Italy and then coming back to France again. So it's a changing picture. But both Allied governments have decided that there is an upper limit for the number of Germans you can have in France, which would allow an invasion to be feasible. If they go over a certain number of divisions on the French coast, then they don't have enough troops to fight them, so an invasion isn't possible. So Bletchley's order of battle isn't only useful from a military point of view of what you have to fight. It was also politically really important because there is this threshold where if too many Germans appear in the order of battle, then the invasion might be postponed or even cancelled. And as time goes on, these numbers become a bit of a political football. And there are several occasions when Churchill is kind of accused of using these numbers as an excuse for, oh no, we need to wait a bit longer. But the problem is the longer you wait, the more resources you have, but also the more Germans that turn up. I mean, in the event, in the summer of 1943, there are perhaps 40 plus divisions of Germans in France. By summer 44, by the time of D-Day, there are 58. So the German strength, that graph is upward. So there isn't much of an excuse for hanging around, really. Your improvements have to go faster than the other guy's improvements for it still to be possible.
Last night, some of the young gentlemen of the RAF took me to Berlin. The pilot was called Jock. We went out and stood around a big black four-motored Lancaster, D for dog. Up in that part of England, the air hums and throbs with the sound of aircraft motors all day. But for half an hour before takeoff, the skies are dead, silent, and expectant. The green light flashed, and we were rolling, 10 seconds ahead of schedule. The takeoff was smooth as silk. The wheels came up, and D-Dog started the long climb. We were flying in the third wave. Dave, the navigator, who was sitting back with his maps, charts, and compasses, said, "The attack ought to begin in exactly 2 minutes." We were still over the clouds. But suddenly, those dirty gray clouds turned white. We were over the outer searchlight defenses. The clouds below us were white and we were black. D-Dog seemed like a black bug on a white sheet. The flak began coming up, but none of it close. We were still a long way from Berlin. I didn't realize just how far. By this time, we were about 30 miles from our target area in Berlin. That 30 miles was the longest flight I have ever made. Dead on time, Buzz, the bomb aimer, reported, "Target indicator is going down." The same moment, the sky ahead was lit up by bright yellow flares. Off to starboard, another kite went down in flames. And then, with no warning at all, D-Dog was filled with an unhealthy white light. I was standing just behind Jock and could see all the seams on the wings. His slender body lifted, half out of the seat, as he jammed the control column forward and to the left. I could see his fingernails turn white as he gripped the wheel. D-Dog was corkscrewing. As Jock hauled the dog up again, I was thrown to the other side of the cockpit. And there below were more incendiaries, blowing white and then turning red. The cookies, the 4,000-pound high explosives, were bursting below like great sunflowers gone mad. And then as we started down again, still held in the lights, I remembered that the dog still had one of those cookies and a whole basket of incendiaries in his belly, and the light still held it. And I was very frightened. Finally, we were out of the cone, flying level. I looked down, and the white fires had turned red. They were beginning to merge and spread, just like butter does on a hot plate. The bomb doors were open. Boz called his directions. Five left, five left. And then there was a gentle, confident upward thrust under my feet, and Boz said, "Cookie gone." A few seconds later, the incendiaries went. And D-Dog seemed lighter and easier to handle. By this time, all those patches of white on black had turned yellow and started to flow together. Another searchlight caught us, but didn't hold us. More of those yellow flares came down and hung about us. I haven't seen so much light since the war began. The navigator sang out the new course and we were heading for home. I looked on the port beam at the target area. There was a red, sullen, obscene glare. The fires seemed to have found each other. And we were heading home. There were four reporters on this operation. Two of them didn't come back. Two friends of mine, Norman Stockton of Australian Associated Newspapers, and Lowell Bennett, an American representing International News Service. There is something of a tradition amongst reporters that those who are prevented by circumstances from filing their stories will be covered by their colleagues. This has been my effort to do so. I have no doubt that Bennett and Stockton would have given you a better report of last night's activities. Berlin was a kind of orchestrated hell, a terrible symphony of light and flame.
You've described the viewpoints of Stalin, Churchill, and the Americans. How did the leaders seek to resolve this tension?
Well, the big event at the end of 1943 is the Tehran Conference. And this is where the three of them get together face to face in Iran to figure out what to do, basically. At that point, the Russians and the British had mounted a joint invasion of Iran. So Tehran was full of Allied troops. And so it was a good place to meet. Stalin was difficult to meet because he didn't like going anywhere, really. And the previous occasions when Churchill had met Stalin, he'd had to go to Moscow to do it. But at the same time, Roosevelt was disabled. He didn't travel very well. So it was a question of how can they get everybody together. And he did actually manage to persuade Roosevelt to travel all the way to Tehran. The Western leaders, Churchill and Roosevelt, actually had a meeting in Cairo beforehand as well. But they had to be kind of a bit canny about that because the concern was that if Stalin thought they were having a meeting prior to the meeting, his suspicions about them plotting against him, which existed already, would just get worse.
Understandably so, as well, you'd have thought. And what was the main outcome of the Tehran Conference?
Well, the main outcome is that Stalin presses again for a second front as soon as possible. And by December 1943, he's not going to get his attack in summer 43. It's too late. But the next window when an offensive can be launched is the summer of 1944. And Churchill and Roosevelt agree that an invasion, a second front, will be opened. And they set the date of 1st of May 1944 as the date for it all to happen. As history tells us, that date actually slipped, again, because of supply of landing craft and one thing, and the various preparations. The thing that Stalin agrees to in return, if you like, is he agrees that the Soviets will launch as big an operation as they can on the Eastern Front to tie down as many German troops as possible on that side while the invasion goes ahead on the Western Allied side.
So despite certain difficulties that you've mentioned about Stalin's reluctance to leave Russia, about Roosevelt's difficulty travelling, in general, were relations quite positive then at the conference?
I think it was in everybody's interest to make it look as positive as possible. And there's news footage of them all, you know, shaking one of those hands and looking happy. But there was still an extraordinary amount of suspicion. Mm. The Soviets and Stalin in particular were kind of pathologically suspicious of what the Western allies were up to. And the Americans certainly were already looking to what the post-war situation might be and who would hold the balance of power at the end of the war. And this is why, in some ways, a second front by the Western allies is important, because one of the other options is you leave the Russians to get on with it. But if you end up with Russians at Calais, you know, it's not an ideal outcome for the Western powers. So there is a certain amount of self-interest in getting involved in the race to Berlin from the Western direction as well as from the Eastern direction.
So in order to make appearances look very positive, everybody's getting on, was there anything in particular that took place at the conference?
Well, they had a number of formal events, including a dinner towards the end of the conference. And for this, Churchill, who was aware of the sort of symbolic significance as everybody else, had had a thing called the Sword of Stalingrad, manufactured in Sheffield. You see pictures of it. It's an enormous sort of medieval-style cruciform-hilted sword, about 4 feet long, with a very elaborate scabbard and decorated and all the rest of it. And the idea of this was it would be a gift from King George V to the citizens of Stalingrad and the greater population of the Soviet Union, and a commemoration of their triumphant victory at Stalingrad. This is all fine. He took it along and he presented it formally to Stalin, and Stalin took it. And there's actually a newsreel film of this, which I watched the other day. And you see Stalin take the sword and he kisses the scabbard and he sort of holds it up for everyone to see. There's then a break in the film. Mm-hmm. The reason there's a break in the film is because at that point, apparently, Stalin turned to Marshal Voroshilov, who was behind him, and said, "Here, you know, you take the sword." And Voroshilov, for whatever reason, grabbed it the wrong way up, and the sword fell out of the scabbard and fell on the floor, and it was all a bit awkward.
That didn't make it into the newsreel.
That doesn't make it into the newsreel. The newsreel kind of jumps ahead, but it did cause a certain amount of embarrassment that this spectacular present had been thrown on the floor by the Soviets. I'm not sure it fooled anyone particularly, though. And the underlying tensions was they're very much still there. And he would only believe Churchill when he saw troops on the beach. You know, he thought most of what he was told was likely to be fabrication, even if it wasn't.
Over the sawtoothed and snow-capped peaks of the Hamadan and Iraqi mountains to Tehran, the route flown by the British and United States leaders and their staffs to meet the Soviet delegates in the drafting of the plan for victory. The start of the four-day conference in the Persian capital, which, in effect, signs the death warrant of Nazi Germany. Impressive security measures have been taken for this critical and most momentous conference, which will shape the destiny of mankind. It was at the Soviet embassy that one of the most moving ceremonies of the war took place. Marshal Stalin received the Stalingrad sword from Mr. Churchill, the magnificent token of British admiration for Russian courage, fashioned at the command of His Majesty the King. For the first time in this war, the three Allied leaders had at last been brought together from the ends of the earth. Following the design for Japanese punishment framed in the Cairo meetings, came the conference to decide the fate of Germany. The joint authors of this momentous declaration have planned the shape of things to come. Allied chiefs of staff have formulated operational plans so gigantic in scope that students of war are already forecasting a crushing all-out offensive involving many millions of men. They feel that preparations are now very close to completion. But let us leave speculation to the wise. Let us dwell upon the concrete things that are open for all to discuss. The infinitely gratifying thought that Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin have set the ball rolling for the grand finale. That Britain, America and Russia are bound together in invincible unity. The stage is set for unprecedented warfare for our tomorrows, and concord among nations for the days to follow.
What does the agreement forged in Tehran mean for developments in 1944?
We've talked about the fact that the Allied powers agree that there's going to be an invasion. That's not part of the communique. You're obviously not going to lay out your tactics to the enemy. So the newsreels and things just talk about them all getting on very well, and they don't announce anything specific about what the outcome is. But in fact, the powers have agreed to this invasion to take place in May 44. And preparations for that invasion have already been underway because the Allies back in the spring had agreed that they would have a supreme commander in Europe for the invasion. This is the post that is ultimately held by Eisenhower. And they set up an organisation called the Chief of Staff to the Supreme Allied Commander, which is shortened to the acronym COSSAC. And COSSAC, under a British general called Frederick Morgan, had been in operation since March. So they were 9 months into making the plan for the invasion and figuring out which beaches to attack. And
before the appointment of a Supreme Allied Commander.
Yes. And so one of the public consequences of Tehran is that Eisenhower was appointed in December 1943. And he is appointed Supreme Allied Commander in Europe.
London newspapers this morning are practically unanimous in acclaiming the appointment of General Eisenhower to lead the invasion of Germany. The Express praises the general for welding the fighting men of our two races into one whole, happy, and formidable instrument of battle. The Dispatch says Eisenhower won very high praise everywhere for the brilliant way he handled the first command, fusing joint British and American land, sea, and air forces. The Observer says Eisenhower has a grand knack of finding talents and mixing them. And the Times adds he has the gift of getting the best out of subordinates because he's big enough to leave them do the job he has given them in their own way.
You don't have to be a genius to work out that we have a Supreme Allied Commander in Europe because there's going to be more fighting in Europe. I mean, admittedly, the war is already going on in Italy, but, you know, I don't think you'd have to be a genius to work out that this means an invasion is potentially likely. And you can see that in the German preparations around that time. And it's actually reflected in a lot of the signals traffic that Bletchley intercepts. One of the things they are able to read around Christmas 42, spring of 43, are Field Marshal von Rundstedt's appreciations. And these are documents he writes as Oberbefehlshaber West, which is the commander in the West. He's in Paris, and he's in charge of defending against an invasion, basically. And he writes these monthly or six-weekly documents back to Berlin where he describes what he thinks is going to happen and how his preparations are getting on. And those are transmitted using Lorenz. And so Bletchley is able to read a number of those messages. They're not read very quickly. Quite often the decryption takes a couple of weeks or even longer, but they filter through. And there are a couple of those around the end of 1943, which are really crucial, where he makes statements like that the Allies' preparations are almost complete, for example, is one, and that basically they can expect an invasion sort of imminently from now on. He's pretty comfortable that it's all going to happen in 1944 and probably sooner rather than later, as soon as the weather is good enough. So from March onwards, really, he thinks an invasion can be expected.
So they haven't perhaps pinned down where, but they're pretty sure of when.
He has in his mind a good idea of when, and he's got a fairly good idea where as well. I mean, the Atlantic Wall extends from Norway to Spain, but northern France is the likeliest option. And the German defences reflect that the defences around Calais are the strongest parts of the Atlantic Wall. His intelligence sources, I mean, the Abwehr tell you anything you like during this period. They report all sorts of rumours and counter-rumours about where an invasion might happen. But the sort of the headline principle that one is coming is pretty clear to the Germans.
What preparations were those?
Well, one of the things that happens in late 1943 is that Field Marshal Rommel arrives in France. The British know him of old. He's most famous for commanding the Africa Corps in the Western Desert. And so he's no stranger to the British press, albeit as an enemy. After the German collapse in North Africa, he had been transferred to Northern Italy for a period in 1943 in charge of an outfit called Army Group B. He is then moved along with Army Group B to Normandy as a subordinate of von Rundstedt's. But he is specifically put in charge of coastal defences and invasion preparations. So he has a specific kind of army group command in terms of, you know, being a battlefield general, but he also has this kind of inspectorate job, which is more broad, checking on all the defences. And again, like the appointment of Eisenhower, Rommel's appearance in France, Bletchley pick it up fairly early on because there's message traffic. They detect that Army Group B has moved from Italy to France, and thus Rommel has probably gone with it. But then, of course, the German press pick up on it and he appears in propaganda newsreels, inspecting defences and everything else. So both sides' preparations are, on the one hand, covert in terms of the detailed planning, but also overt in the sense that generals are getting appointed and appearing in the newspapers.
Quite obvious, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a certain amount that you can't really hide these things, you know, certainly on this kind of scale.
Generalfeldmarschall Rommel im Hauptquartier des Oberbefehlshabers West, Generalfeldmarschall von Rundstedt. Die beiden Truppenführer im Gespräch. Im Sonderauftrag des Führers besichtigt Generalfeldmarschall Rommel die Befestigungsanlagen an der Atlantikküste. Neben den Offizieren werden auch erfahrene und bewährte Unteroffiziere zu der Besichtigung herangezogen. Generalfeldmarschall Rommel lässt sich von den örtlichen Kommandeuren hier von einem Offizier der Kriegsmarine Bericht erstatten. Die Einsatzbereitschaft der Waffen wird vorgeführt. Unsere Gegner sollen wissen, dass jeder Landungsversuch eine deutsche Abwehr von ungeheurer Kraft auslösen wird.
What you don't see in the newsreels is how unhappy Rommel was with the defences when he got there.
And were the British aware that Rommel was disappointed with the state of the defences?
To a certain extent, yes. It's clear that he accelerates the construction programme. And some of this doesn't come from signals intelligence. It comes from other forms of information, like stuff from the French resistance, for example, are sending back information. And although those reports are going to different parts of British intelligence, they do also filter down to Bletchley. So they're seeing these reports alongside the signals intelligence they're getting. And it becomes clear that the building programme is accelerated. The other thing is the Germans kind of fall to arguing about what should actually be done about the invasion, because von Rundstedt has a different conception of how the battle should be fought from Rommel. Because Rommel has this idea that his experience of North Africa was that Allied air power was extremely disruptive, and that once the battle starts, moving large numbers of troops from one place to another when they're open to air attack is very, very difficult. So you really need to have everybody where you need them to be before the battle starts, because moving them around once it starts is very costly. So he calculates that the best thing to do is to put all of the troops available to him really in the shop window, in or near the beach, and fight the battle on the beach, essentially.
But von Rundstedt disagreed.
Von Rundstedt disagrees. He has this idea that there aren't enough Germans to go around, and to spread them out too thinly is to lose. So he has this idea that mobile forces, particularly panzer divisions, should be held back more sort of in central France. And the idea is you don't worry if the Allies get ashore and establish themselves a little bit. You have this enormous force that you can then punch wherever they happen to have turned up. So you don't have to spread your troops out between Pas-de-Calais and Normandy and the Loire or wherever. You just keep them central and you can strike back. Rommel's argument is that won't work, because the moment they try and move, the Allies will bomb them. And in the event, we know from the Normandy campaign that one of the things that really hamstrung the German operations was the moment they tried to move troops around, the air power was so powerful that things just got blown up all the time. But this argument is going on from sort of Christmas 43 right through till D-Day. Not much of it filters through in the information Bletchley's seeing, but they're seeing the order of battle that results from it. And that order of battle, in terms of where the German forces are deployed and who's in charge of them, is kind of a compromise between the two options. It is a kind of a bit of a worst of both worlds. And so he's certainly aware of that part.
Since I spoke to you last, not only have the Hun invaders been driven from the lands they had ravaged, but the guts of the German army have been largely torn out by Russian valor and generalship. The American victories in the Pacific, and in particular their latest conquest and liberation of the Marshall Islands, constitute superb examples of the combination of naval, air, and military force. When the signal is given, the whole circle of avenging nations will hurl themselves upon the foe and batter out the life of the cruelest tyranny which has ever sought to bar the progress of mankind.
We've spoken about the Allied preparations for Overlord, about the German activities in Normandy, but surely the war is continuing. It's not just everyone waiting for the invasion.
Absolutely not. And the other campaigns that Britain and the US are involved in the Pacific, and in particular in Italy, are continuing apace at the same time, and Bletchley's supporting all those campaigns. The winter from 1943 into 1944 in Italy is particularly a hard-fought period, and in middle of January, you get the second amphibious landing in Italy at Anzio, which didn't go quite as well as planned, I think it'd be fair to say. And then the fighting around Monte Cassino starts in January, but carries on right through till the middle of May even. So there's huge fighting to come in Italy through that spring period. And we're actually going to come back to that in a podcast in March.
In September, we jumped on the toe of Italy at Messina and hacked the enemy on the shins at Salerno. In January came the kick on the kneecap at Anzio, 30 miles south of Rome. Covering fire was laid down as landing craft of all types swept into the beaches in the wake of the minesweepers. While still some distance offshore, desultory shelling from enemy artillery was experienced. Troops in the first assault craft were astonished as they came ashore by the absence of enemy resistance. At this early stage, there was every indication that the Fifth Army had pulled off a brilliant surprise maneuver. Consolidating the swiftly won position comes the second wave of assaulting troops. Not a casualty suffered and hardly a shot fired. Those few precious unmolested hours were sufficient for us to establish ourselves firmly. Once the initial impetus was spent, it became the German intention to try and contain our force within its defensive perimeter. The town of Anzio itself bore much evidence of the pounding it had received. Here and there, groups of German prisoners are to be seen, shepherded by fellows with a natural dislike for Nazis. At the time these pictures were taken, this road marked the boundary of our beachhead. Along it march American and British troops, the boys to whom we say, well done in this latest Anglo-American feat of arms.
With the war at sea, Bletchley Park had a real coup around December 1943, didn't they?
They did. This is the sinking of the Scharnhorst, German battleship. And this is a very interesting story from Bletchley Park's point of view. We've covered in this podcast previously the sinking of the Bismarck back in 1941. And I think I explained at that point that at that period, Naval Enigma was still presenting quite a challenge to Bletchley Park. And although they are involved in the Bismarck campaign, the part they play in the sinking of the ship is slightly peripheral. You can't really attribute much of the success of the operation directly to Bletchley. The situation with the Scharnhorst at the end of 1943 is much clearer. Bletchley can take more of the credit than they did before. The reason for this is that they are able to hear a lot more of the communications leading up to the battle. And not only do they hear the messages, but they break a lot of the messages in a time scale that allows them to be relevant. Because this is the problem with Bletchley, is it's not only intercepting messages, you then have to decrypt the messages and distribute them to the people who need them in a time scale that means they're not out of date by the time they get there.
You say they're able to hear much more and therefore intercept and therefore have more information. Why was that?
At the end of 1943, the Germans have a number of major ships left. They've had a diminishing number of battleships and heavy cruisers and things ever since the beginning of the war. And with the loss of Bismarck and with the loss of other ships, the number of options they have is dwindling. And the German Navy kind of focuses its efforts on Norway. They think that forays into the Atlantic, I mean, Bismarck was a classic case, wasn't tremendously successful. And the areas around the Channel and the UK are just, air power is too strong down there. But up in Norway, these ships have a real opportunity to strike at the convoys that the Allies are still sending to the Russians. And so they still have quite a lot of strategic influence up there. So Tirpitz, Lützow and Scharnhorst all move up to Norway. And that represents a pretty powerful striking force. And the Royal Navy obviously have to have the home fleet up in Scapa, but it means they have to send quite large escort groups with the convoys that are going to Russia because these ships could come out and attack them. Unfortunately for the Germans, by the autumn winter of 1943, they're down to one ship. Lützow needed to be refitted, sent back to Germany. And then Tirpitz in September is famously attacked by Royal Navy midget submarines. And although they don't sink the ship, they do enough damage to it that it means it can't sail again for some time. So that just leaves Scharnhorst. Scharnhorst was moved to a different fjord, having been in the same fjord as Tirpitz. Perhaps fortunately for the Germans, it was moved to a different one, which meant the midget submarines couldn't get it. But what this meant, crucially for Bletchley, was whereas Tirpitz had a landline telephone, basically they had cables from the dock which allowed them to communicate with Berlin and everywhere else over landline, and thus completely securely. Because Scharnhorst had moved, she was forced to communicate with German Naval High Command by wireless. And the moment they start sending wireless messages,
much more easy to intercept.
Bletchley can get in on that action, so they can start intercepting those messages. And that's exactly what happens. From the middle of December, the Germans have cooked up a plan that they call Operation Ostfront, Operation Eastern Front. It's not a very imaginative code name because the idea is to sink convoys in the Arctic, which will then help the German army in the east by stopping the supplies getting to the Russians. So it's not a very good code name if it gives away what the operation's all about. So they have Operation Ostfront, and the idea is that when a suitable convoy comes along, Scharnhorst and its escorting destroyers will sail out and attack that convoy and sink all those ships. The problem is, you have a number of factors. You have to wait for the right convoy to come along. You have to wait for the weather to be right. You have to use air reconnaissance aircraft to firstly try and find the convoy and then find it when it's in a suitable position to be attacked. You also have to identify whether the Royal Navy sent a big escort with it or not. So there's a lot of factors at play for the Germans. What this means is they generate a lot of radio messages because Scharnhorst gets put on standby to sail, either on 6 hours to sail or 3 hours to sail on some occasions. And these orders go out to Scharnhorst and it's told, get ready. And then they go, oh, no, the weather isn't right. So they stand down, or they go, oh, no, we haven't found the convoy, and they stand down. So all of these intercepts at Bletchley, they go, right, it's clear that when a window opens, this is what the Germans want to do. And because the British know when their convoys are sailing, it almost provides an opportunity to go, if we put enough ships at sea and we protect the convoys in the right way, we will eventually lure Scharnhorst out, and that's our moment to pounce. And at Christmas 1943, that's almost exactly what happens. The Scharnhorst sailed. Various radio messages were sent, both to and from the ship, which were picked up by Bletchley and were passed on.
Being encrypted by Enigma, were those much speedier then? Was the turnaround time a lot quicker from interception to reading them?
It varies. Some of them are read quite quickly. Some of them aren't read at all. Some of the early messages when she's sailing are sent in what's called offizier, which is for very, very important messages. The German Navy would encrypt a message twice. They basically run it through the Enigma machine twice with two different settings. And that makes them extraordinarily difficult to break, because when you break them the first time, you're left with ciphertext again. So cribs and things don't work. So Bletchley isn't able to break all of the messages by any means. They are able to break some of them, and that gives them enough kind of hints and tips. Also, you have, because there are aircraft involved, German reconnaissance operations looking for the convoys, you don't just have naval Enigma to look at. But the crucial thing is, basically on Christmas Day, the order goes out for Scharnhorst to sail. The Germans have decided that all the relative conditions have been met, although the weather's pretty terrible. There's a convoy in the right place. They think it's not well enough escorted. They think they can have a go. So the order Ostfront 5 p.m. goes out at 3:30 in the afternoon on Christmas Day. By the early hours of Boxing Day, that message has been broken and passed on to the Admiralty. So they know she's probably putting to sea. I mean, it's not certain, because the Germans could still cancel, and they've cancelled several times in the previous few weeks, but they're pretty sure she's putting to sea. And as a consequence, they have large forces out in the Arctic Ocean waiting for her to appear. And she is found on the late afternoon of Boxing Day, 1943. The battle lasts into the early evening. Ironically, Scharnhorst was escorted by destroyers, but because they were worried about where the convoys were, they actually detached the destroyers to go and look for the convoy and left Scharnhorst on her own. So she was completely unescorted at that point. And the battle more or less starts as it's getting dark, because you're in the Arctic. There's very few hours of daylight at Christmas. And so the battle has to be fought using radar. And by that period of the war, although the German ships have radar to control their gunnery, the radar control that the British ships have is much better. So the chances are that the British ships are going to land more hits on the German ship than the Germans are going to land on the British. And by 8 p.m., Scharnhorst is sunk by, amongst others, the battleship Duke of York, which is up there with a number of cruisers and other vessels. And that's kind of it for the German Navy in the Arctic at that point. Tirpitz remains in being, remains afloat for the best part of another year. Tirpitz isn't sunk until late 1944. But there are only very short periods when she's actually seaworthy, because the RAF launch a number of attacks on her at various points. And so she never puts to sea in any meaningful way after that. And this is kind of the end of the German effort against the Russian convoys. Bletchley Park Naval Section can claim quite a certain amount of credit for this, because the reading of all of that traffic, both in the build-up to the operation and during the operation itself, is highly significant.
The German Navy, so proudly built up by that smug strategical genius, the Führer, is slowly but surely being wiped out. Now the Scharnhorst, the 26,000-ton battleship, has gone to the bottom, a not unusual result of action against the Royal Navy. The Scharnhorst certainly had a checkered career. Launched in 1936, completed in 1939, her main job was commerce raiding, carried out as often as not with her sister ship, the Gneisenau. Off Norway, her 11-inch guns finally accounted for the aircraft carrier Glorious, her only real success. She fled to France, and when the bombing got too hot, she fled again. We all remember her dash through the Channel, together with her sister ship and the Prince Eugen. In desperation, Hitler sent her off to radar convoys to Russia, but he obviously underestimated the opposition. The Royal Navy turned up in strength, and yet another old score was duly wiped off. Now, off the North Cape, she's fought her first and last real fight against the big guns of our capital ships, which were under the command of Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser. To the Admiral and the men who served him so magnificently, we give due thanks for a grand Christmas present. As for the rest of the German Navy, well, ships like the Duke of York are only waiting for an introduction.
What else was happening at Bletchley Park at the start of 1944?
Perhaps the most well-known event of January and February 1944 was the arrival of the first Colossus at Bletchley.
And Colossus is?
Colossus is a machine used to assist with the breaking of Lorentz teleprinter traffic, known as Tunny or latterly Fish.
Called Colossus because of its size, I'm presuming.
Yes, yes. The nickname arose because it was an enormous machine.
And it was invented by Tommy Flowers, is that correct?
Yes. Colossus specifically is Tommy Flowers' creation. However, Colossus doesn't come out of nowhere. It's part of an evolution of technology which is applied to the problem of Lorentz decryption. I mean, these signals were first detected in 1914 and 1941. And firstly, they had to figure out how the cipher worked, and then they had to figure out how methodology for breaking it. Those two tasks were achieved by Bill Tuck, famously, about whom we have the little exhibition, and John Tiltman. And then it was subsequently, at the beginning of 1943, that Max Newman was appointed and the Newmanry was created. And the purpose of the Newmanry is to develop gadgets of various kinds that can perform the code-breaking tasks that Tuck and Tiltman and Turing, to a certain extent, have developed in the previous period. So what Tommy Flowers is doing is taking these concepts, these mathematical and theoretical concepts that have been developed, and turning them into a practical device.
There were machines prior to Colossus. What sort of machines were they? What were they doing?
One of the first machines that's developed is the Tunny machine, as it's called. And this doesn't do code breaking per se. It's simply an analogue of the cipher machine itself. And what that allows you to do, it's a bit like having your own machine. It allows you to type in ciphertext. If you know the correct key, type in the ciphertext and get out plain text. So it simplifies the decryption process once you know the key settings of the machine. But you also need machines for that much trickier job of finding out what the key settings for the machine actually are. Max Newman starts looking into that at the start of 1943. And Tommy Flowers was one of the people he approached, along with Wynne Williams down at Malvern at the Telecommunications Research Establishment. And there's sort of a number of people that work on the problem. And the first machine that's developed is nicknamed Heath Robinson after the cartoonist, because it has a number of paper tapes and wheels and sprockets and all manner of eccentric components. But Heath Robinson does the job, or it's part of the job of key finding. The first of those is installed in June of 1943, and it works okay. It doesn't work brilliantly, but it can get the job done. But there are a number of issues with it. There being a war on, and this being how Bletchley works, they can't wait till they have a perfect device. They have to go with what they've got. So a number of additional Robinsons are manufactured in the back half of 1943. And so by March 44, they have four of these machines. But it's clear that these machines aren't the perfect solution to the problem. They can be improved upon. And Flowers is approached to develop what becomes Colossus, which is kind of a second generation machine, if you like, that will do the job, but will do it better and faster.
What sort of improvements did he design then that made it more efficient or work a little more reliably than Heath Robinson?
The problem with the Robinson machines is that the key finding process involves comparing a version of the ciphertext, which is teleprinter tape essentially, to a possible version of the key, which is also a teleprinter tape. On the Robinson is also a teleprinter tape. So you have these two paper tapes, and the two tapes have to run very, very quickly. And they also have to run in perfect synchronization with one another, because if they get out of alignment, then the comparisons don't work, basically. And this is a gross oversimplification of how the machine works. But the basic problem is you have these two paper tapes and all the unreliabilities that leads to. Flowers has a background in electronic valves. He's been developing telephone exchange systems, which, rather than using mechanical relays and arms and things, can do the job electronically with valves. And he sees what he considers the perfect solution to this problem is to do the whole thing with valves, do it entirely electronically. And he comes up with the concept and he says, what you should do is replace everything with valves. It'd be great. The response he gets is, that's a jump too far. That's not going to work. Nobody else was as confident in the technology as Flowers was. He was ploughing a bit of a lone furrow in that respect. So what he does is he comes up with a compromise machine, which still has one paper tape, but does everything else with valves. So one of the tapes has been replaced with valves and the other paper tape is still there. What this means is that the synchronization problem is greatly simplified because you can use the electronics to just follow the one tape, essentially. And it has all sorts of other advantages. It runs faster. It's easier to set up because you're representing one of the tapes by interchangeable plugs on the machine instead of having to produce a physical paper tape. So it's way better in some respects than the previous Robinson machines. And so there's been a kind of generational leap forward in terms of the technology.
Was Colossus decrypting messages, or was it a bit like the bomb machine, part of the larger process? Did it just sort of play a significant but specific role within that process?
It's very much part of a process. What Colossus does, and what Robinson did as well, is it looks for a particular part of the key setting of the original Lorentz machine. There are a number of pencil and paper tasks, and indeed other machine tasks, that have to be done after that to get you to plain text German. So it sits in the middle of a workflow, and there are other machines that do other parts of the process. So the Neumann in that period would have been a suite of, you know, a half a dozen or more different machines doing different parts of the task. Colossus is probably the biggest of those machines and the most famous. And to be fair to it, it also attacks the most complex part of the problem as well. So it is at the heart of the tunny breaking process, but it's not the whole process.
This compromise machine, but this example of progress, of development, arrived in January. Did it make an immediate impact?
If you look at the rate at which Bletchley is able to read fish messages, Tunny and fish get used slightly interchangeably as code names. Fish refers to the more general range of different links that the Germans were using with their Lorentz machines, all of which are nicknamed after fish. So Tunny is one of those, but there's also sturgeon and bream and jellyfish and gurnard and all sorts. If you look at the number of characters per month of decrypt that Bletchley is producing, there isn't a revolutionary change in January when Colossus appears. The number of messages or number of words per month they're able to produce rises on a sort of progressive curve through 1944 and into 1945. So it's an evolution rather than a revolution in that sense. This is partly because when Colossus 1 is delivered in January 44, there are four Robinson machines running and only one Colossus.
Right.
They managed to deliver the second Colossus machine, which is the Mark II, which is improved again, just before D-Day in June 1944. By Christmas of 44, there are seven Colossus machines running, and by April 1945, just before the end of the war, there are 10. So, again, like the bomb, having one machine is great, but having 10 is better. You know? And so the amount they're able to process rises as they get more machines up and running. And they don't abandon the Robinson project at that point. They don't simply switch from, oh, that machine's no longer any good, we'll go to this one. Robinson, the two-tape machines, still are better at certain aspects of Lorentz decryption. There are certain problems that arise which are better solved on a Robinson machine. So they carry on. There are further iterations of that machine. There's a machine which paradoxically is called Old Robinson, which is actually newer than original Robinson, in a typically Bletchley way. And then the Super Robinson after that. So that stream of technological development continues at the same time as Colossus is being delivered. So some of the literature you read will give the layperson the impression that there's kind of, there's nothing and then there's Colossus and then there's everything. It's much more of a flow and an evolution than that.
You described it as a suite of machines in the Neumannry. There were a whole host of counting machines, copying machines. The Neumannry must have just been abuzz with the racket of clattering machines.
Oh, yes. And hundreds of wrens operating all these machines as well and trying not to electrocute themselves. One of the problems with Colossus is that it carries a lot of current. You have to treat it with a certain amount of circumspection. The other story about it I like, which reveals one of its imperfections, is that one of the issues with Robinson was it produces statistical results. And these statistical results would flash up on a little screen and a wren operator would have to write the numbers down, basically. And that is difficult to do and it introduces human error and everything else. So when they built Colossus, they thought, well, we'll have an automatic printer attached to the machine. And they acquired a suitable, basically an electronic typewriter, which is all wired up so that the output would be produced electronically. The problem with this was that the carriage return on the printer was so forceful that every time it operated, it would nudge the whole typewriter a couple of inches further away from the machine. And if you let it run for too long, it would track off across the room and unplug itself.
Totter away from the machine.
It would totter away from the machine on its stand. So the Wrens, they would actually rope it to the foot of the Colossus machine.
Oh my goodness.
They'd have to tether it with a length of rope so it didn't just set off across the room and unplug itself.
Perilous job for the Wrens as well, though, doesn't it?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
The eventual impact of Colossus was really significant, and the machine turned out to be of incredible significance. Were people aware at the time when Colossus 1 was delivered of its importance?
I'm not sure they were. I mean, obviously, everything would have been very secret. But even Flowers himself played it down to a certain extent. Obviously, he designed a machine that he didn't know if it would work. You know, they tested it in the factory, but it's always a gamble. Tommy Flowers, even in his own personal diary, slightly downplays these events. On the 18th of January, when the first machine was delivered, his diary just simply says, Colossus delivered to BP, full stop. It's just like a little personal note. He then tinkered with it for several weeks, and it did its first successful job 3 weeks later on the 8th of February. His diary entry for 8th of February is, Colossus did its first job, car broke down on the way home.
Right.
Okay. Which was the more significant event in his life. And given the legacy that the machine has in terms of electronic computing for the 75 years since, car broke down on the way home is a very downbeat introduction to it.
Careless talk can cost lives. Words can sink ships, lose weapons, mean the failure of military ventures. Remember these rules in even the most carefully guarded conversation. If you hear it from someone else, don't pass it on. If you see it yourself, tell no one. Don't talk unless you read it in the newspapers or hear it on the air. These are things our enemies would like to know about our men, planes, ships, and supplies. Where, how, when, how many, what kind. Let's make them find out the hard way on the battlefields of the world.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.